For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
Australia's done really well as a healthcare system for a very long time, but our healthcare system was set up 40 years ago, probably around the birth of Medicare, for a very different health paradigm where people had acute infectious conditions often, people weren't living into their 80s, and we didn't have the prevalence of mental health or complex chronic conditions that we do now.
That was Professor Claire Jackson, who is Director of the Mater Research Institute's Centre for Health System Reform and Integration at the University of Queensland. Professor Jackson and her colleague, Professor Diana O'Halloran, from the Department of General Practice at Western Sydney University, have been champions of health reform for many years. They've just written a perspective for the MJA in which they describe the Australian health system as, quote, bruised, bleeding, unsustainable, and rightly criticised as increasingly failing both users and providers of care, unquote. A solution is in sight, they say, but it's going to take boldness, courage, and leadership from a lot of people in many sectors. Professors Jackson and O'Halloran are my special guests today. What has triggered your wanting to write this? Has there been a specific downturn that has particularly caught your attention?
So Di and I have both been involved in really healthcare reform for a very long time in different states and different perspectives. Being a general practitioner, you see the great strengths and weaknesses in a healthcare system because in general practice, we are really the crossroads between public and private, Commonwealth and state funded. And often we piggy in the middle with patients with chronic complex conditions or mental health issues or issues that bridge the health social care areas. Australia's done really well as a healthcare system for a very long time, but our healthcare system was set up 40 years ago, probably around the birth of Medicare, for a very different health paradigm where people had acute infectious conditions often, people weren't living into their 80s, and we didn't have the prevalence of mental health or complex chronic conditions that we do now. Every 4 years, the international community is benchmarked by the Commonwealth Fund around their healthcare system. Yep. It's the Mirror report you'd be familiar with, Kate, from the Commonwealth Fund. It picks 11 of the probably most impressive healthcare systems across the OECD and benchmarks them. And last time, 2017, Australia rated 2 across 11 different metrics and number 1 on healthcare outcomes. We were pretty chuffed around that. Mm-hmm. We were marked down around equity, around Indigenous health outcomes. And then last week, we were benchmarked again, 2021, across those 11 countries, and we've now slipped to number 3. We're still number 1 in terms of healthcare outcomes, which is very reassuring. The system's struggling on, but we've dropped significantly around access to care, around out-of-pockets, and also around waiting times. And we've dropped down to number 8 around processes of care. And that's that clunkiness that Di and I have referred to in our article between Commonwealth and state-funded systems and the inability for care to move effortlessly around different settings, which is really what many Australians need in their healthcare currently. However, the good news from the Mirror report last week is that we've now moved to about number 1 in equity. So the work around Close the Gap that all states and territory and Commonwealth governments put in is really starting to be noticed. And that's something that we really should be celebrating.
So we're living longer, and our illnesses tend to be chronic rather than acute more often than not. What else is showing up in the system that suggests that the system is struggling a bit?
Well, I'd have to say that the greatest level of strain is showing in the community and in general practice, because the level and complexity of care and the continuity of care that's required is exponentially increasing as that demographic and epidemiology changes, but the system is geared for that rapid throughput, acute or minor sort of episodic care. So the harder the GPs in particular try to provide quality care, the more disadvantaged they are in financial terms, the harder they try and connect with other potential team members, other services, other sectors, the more difficult it is because there are no inbuilt either incentives or pathways And that's the sort of work that we've both been heavily involved in for literally decades now. So it continues to be, however, a battle against the system to try and deliver on inequity. So it's really about time, because the impact is showing, particularly in general practice, recruitment into general practice is falling significantly. So we just have to do something about that.
From a hospital perspective, to pick up on that element, the prevalence of complex chronic conditions now means the demands just become unsustainable for acute care services, ED services, but hospitalizations. Huge numbers of frail elderly arriving in both ED and in the hospital sector, and they are very difficult to be able to assess and process and safely move back to the community in a hurry. Work from the NHS shows that even 4 hours lying on a stretcher, if you're a frail elderly person, means that you can no longer wait there to get out of a chair, and it will be 4 to 6 weeks of rehab to try and get that person back to where they were before they arrived in the ED. So the system really needs to be better at picking up people with preventable issues in the community and caring for them close to where they work and live, with the community provision that is there but is often not able to be sourced or funded.
I talk to a lot of doctors across a lot of different sectors, but the common problem, or certainly a commonality that seems to pop up every time we're talking about the issues within their specialty or whatever, is the dual funded system. You know, the state's taking care of one thing or one set of things and the Commonwealth taking care of the other. Is it as simple as changing that? Is that what will fix everything?
Well, yes, it will, but it's not simple.
No, it's not simple.
That's got to be the quote of the decade.
There you go. So it will solve everything, but how do we get it done?
It will go a long way towards solving what is an absolutely intractable problem.
And yeah. I don't think it's that the result, you know, that it's going to cost an enormous amount or resources aren't there. As Di said, we don't use them very well. And we sit in our silos and we either duplicate what each other are doing in very sort of silly ways, or we actually have these huge gaps that no one's filling because it's too hard. One of the themes that we're picking up in the paper is how difficult it is to move a system once it's locked in the way it is, not only in Australia, but across the OECD. It does take a lot of courage and leadership, and it does mean that you need to move resources, both people and dollars, into an area that's upstream so you can prevent illness or intervene early on, rather than band-aiding a system with a lot of acute care dollars when the opportunity to really make a difference early has passed, and now it's going to be much more challenging, complex and expensive and possibly irreversible to do something at the patient level. The further we get away from the community, the person, the family, the patient, the more we miss the opportunities to make a difference. And I think the New Zealand experience has shown us that. Canterbury's the poster boy internationally with being able to intervene early with patients and communities and make a difference and divert resources and capability into the community, but recognising always we need secondary and tertiary care to back up that community provision because we can't do it on our own.
Di, talk to me about New South Wales' situation. You talk in the paper about how, in many ways, New South Wales Health has done a very good job of this. How did that start and how has it progressed over the last 10 years, say?
You can see that the directions that we need to take in health reform have been fairly obvious for 20 years, even more obvious in the 10 years when we've had one report after another. They've been amazingly consistent in the directions that they have set out, and we've just not had the boldness at political level to try and take that step, the bold steps that are required. Sometimes a change of government or a major change in policy will set us right back. I mean, in New South Wales, we actually had a clear direction set way back in 2007-8 with a Labor government, and then we had a change of government, a hiatus for a while, but then the new Liberal government picked that up slowly, but increasingly certainly. And we have had very strong leadership for the last number of years, maybe 10 years even, particularly from the top end, the Secretary of the Ministry of Health, who set a very clear direction around integrated systems, around person-centered care, around moving from volume to value. It's latched onto the quadruple aim, which is brilliant because that everybody understands that. Doesn't matter whether you're a consumer or a provider or a policy developer or a government official, you can clearly see that a better system is going to deliver on those four quadrants very clearly. That's the direction that they've set. And they have learnt through trial and error. So they haven't tried a program, found that it didn't work terribly well and dosed it and gone off in another direction. They've evaluated it very fully. They've pulled out the learnings. They've applied them religiously in the same direction with the same goals and so on over 3, 4, 5 iterations to the point where we've now got co-commissioning, coordinated commissioning between PHNs and LHDs, where for the first time you've got an equal relationship. Now, we still don't have clarity from Commonwealth and state level about what's the bottom line? What do you really expect PHNs and LHDs to do together? But co-commissioning starts to step that out. You know, the equal relationship, local planning, the local co-design, pooling of funds, the engagement of other providers, the delivery of care that's very ordered towards a particular patient group in a particular context. And you've got the guarantee of sustainability. We're not going to change the policy direction next week. We're going to keep at it. And that gives a lot of confidence, I think.
I'm chatting today with Professors Claire Jackson and Di O'Halloran about how we can reform an overcomplicated health system. Their perspective is available at mja.com.au and the full address is in the show notes for this podcast. If you are enjoying this podcast, you can subscribe to our feed for free. Just go to your usual podcast provider and search for Medical Journal of Australia and we should pop up. You can also find all our episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are also free to access. Back to our chat. What are other states not doing? Is it the co-commissioning that's key here?
It is, but it's the journey that's been... Co-commissioning could potentially provide something of a short circuit for that journey, but there's no doubt. It needs hard work, it needs commitment, it needs leadership, it needs a vision, it needs principles, and it needs investment. And it needs a bunch of enablement from both Commonwealth and state governments. So it's not a simple solution. It's a potential solution with a lot of work.
And I think the other thing is that it needs a change in culture where you actually think about a problem across the system and not, well, I'm here and for me to solve it, it needs to look like this. An example probably from Victoria during COVID, and COVID's really made us think very differently about everything. That is a situation where people were unwell in the community and needing a hospital in the home environment. Now, hospital in the home traditionally often meant an outreach from the hospital going out. But in parts of Victoria, the general practice community was thought of, was involved, was resourced, knew the family, knew the patient, were close by, and were able to really do the heavy lifting with remote monitoring and support from their tertiary and secondary sector. That was just a beautiful example of how thinking around how we could solve a problem in a hurry based on where we all were and the most important role, and therefore moving the resourcing across those settings, I thought was a really smart example of how a different culture can really start to address problems much more effectively.
Do you see the COVID pandemic as an opportunity?
I absolutely do. And I think Minister Hunt said the telehealth moved further in 10 days than in 10 years. Absolutely. Di mentioned in the paper just how quickly we're able to move to a one system thinking. We moved to a national cabinet early on. Remember in those early days, the premiers and the prime minister and all the health ministers working together constructively on song with one focus and vision, and amazing things happened. We moved to telehealth because we had to support pregnant women, people at home who were ill, the sort of work we had been hoping to do, but there just wasn't system support for it. We got that moving within a fortnight. So I think COVID showed us that we can work as one system if it's important and if we actually work with one culture. Yeah. And I'm hoping that's what we'll take into the future. But also, I think I need to be cynical and say, as soon as people moved out of that thinking, you know, 6 weeks past April, we fell into our old habits again. And I think we need to have, as Di said, the governance infrastructure to make sure we don't do that and that we keep thinking about how can we together with a single vision really make a difference for Australian communities.
Now, Claire, you mentioned that there's some important things being announced next week or coming to fruition next week. Tell us about those.
Yes, and I think this is just perfect timing, Kate, so thank you for the opportunity. We talked about all the different reviews and reforms and reports that have really gone on since the Macklin papers in the mid-90s about trying to get this whole system. As one patient says to me, I always fall between the bar stool and the wall between Commonwealth-funded and state-funded health settings, and it's true, we've known this for a very long time as patients. So the 10-year plan for the review of primary care services started with Minister Hunt before COVID. It was really going to be a focus on trying to make primary care fit for purpose for the coming decades. During COVID, it was recognised that we had to get this one system focus and that primary care couldn't be reformed as a silo. And so that report will be launched by Minister Hunt in the next month. And the very first recommendation of those 20 recommendations into the future for primary care is all about a one system focus and pulling primary care and secondary and tertiary care together to give really the best value proposition for Australian communities. And then under that, a lot of reforms around funding reform, around that regional approach that Di was talking about, bringing close the gap into this, aged care reform into this, mental health reform into this, and really a prevention and making sure that every Australian has the opportunity for preventive healthcare at a regular occurrence. Bringing patients and their families together as partners is another key part of it. How we can enable people to have much more of a buy-in to their healthcare. Yeah. Over 50% of health resources now are consumed by unhealthy lifestyle. How we can work with people to really radically change that. Because if we could do that, that extra 10% of strain on the current healthcare system would really come off the boil and we could do so much more. Mm-hmm. So it is something I think will really guide much more than primary care over the next 10 years and will certainly be part of what the Australian Health Care Reform Agreements will be looking at over the next 2 years. But it's the opportunity for all the jurisdictions to fine-tune what they're doing in terms of resourcing, funding, and innovating around our healthcare system. Whilst they're flying it, they're changing the engine somewhat. And so I think we'll see that reflected as well.
Di, what do you think?
We're all hanging out for this report. Just can't wait. But the other big piece of work that's going on is the renegotiation of the National Health Reform Agreement. Now, the addendum that came out in June of 2020 was a huge step forward on past agreements. There was really some ambition in that document, I know, because I pulled out every statement that had to do with health system reform, and 14 out of 97 pages were absolutely focused on how to progress health system reform. So that agreement is now in the process of being renegotiated. They take 14 pages forward and expand them. It gives us a template that really should be able to deliver not just the top line visions, but the bottom line requirements. So when you combine that with the 10-year plan and the other pieces of work that are coming to fruition right now, we really do have a shot. So I guess our message is it's time to be bold and no more little steps.
What does all that do for the GP on the front line? What have they got to look forward to in terms of improving the situation that they're in now?
General practice has traditionally been MBS funded to really focus on our own patients. And as I've said before, the MBS has not really kept pace with the contemporary design and resourcing of practices. Also, it's very difficult to care for a patient with a complex chronic condition or a mental health condition across the continuum on your own. And so I think we're hoping that some of that 6.5% of additional funding every year that the Commonwealth places into each state and territory will be recognised as supporting the general practice sector to do a lot more heavy lifting over time around complex chronic care in particular, supporting vulnerable families, disabled folk and their family. Areas that recognise that general practice expertise is essential and needs to be appropriately resourced, but also pulling in initiatives such as the non-dispensing pharmacist, social workers, a lot of allied health expansion, mental health nurses. All those things are really hard to fund within a general practice, but a general practice supported by those sort of external resources in personnel and with funding support for a lot of the time-consuming and important areas of patient care that just aren't recognised anymore under the MBS, those issues, I think, would really revolutionise the opportunity for general practice to have a much bigger input in future care models.
Let's think of this in terms of currently general practice is rewarded for throughput, for volume, and what we need to do is completely adjust the system so that general practice is rewarded for quality, complexity and outcomes. And that requires a very major shift in both financing system and resource support teamwork systems within the practice and across the system.
And I think it's important to stress the MBS will continue as it always has. There's no intent that that changes, but that it needs to be supplemented for particular sorts of patients with particular conditions with a broader team, but also funding for time, as Di said, that is not well remunerated under the MBS. So combining that, the term, I guess, is blended funding, where the MBS will continue to do what it does really well, but supported increasingly in areas where it's under current threat and really is unable to deliver for millions of Australians and their families, that we would support that with a more integrated, innovative models in partnership with state-funded healthcare.
If we wanted to be ambitious, we would move GPs out of their practices. They would not only know their patient groups and their practice populations, but they'd be agents for change in their community. They'd be engaged with PHNs and with other organisations in working with their communities, providing leadership in their communities to influence socioeconomic determinants of health, undertaking teaching and research, all those things that are currently extraordinarily difficult to do at the minute, yet are part of not only the best of past general practice, but ideally hope for the future of general practice as well.
Yeah. Presumably you're hoping that this will help make general practice a more appealing career for students, junior doctors, etc. There's rumours that there's a federal election coming. Are you worried that this might get politicised as it has so often in the past?
We're hoping that the 10-year plan will receive bipartisan support. There's no reason to suspect it won't. Mm-hmm. And as Di said, a lot of that work has been built over many years and has had support from both Labor governments and Liberal governments as well. We actually think it will be challenging for state governments that are already feeling exhausted by the demand needs in their acute sector. Some state governments have an increase in the cost of their health system running at almost 10% a year. So they are feeling very challenged. But I think also they realise that's unsustainable. Yeah. You can't have the entire health budget going, the entire state budget going to health. So I think there's a feeling that it's time. Mm-hmm. But also, as Di said, it's very challenging to move resources and people and power and territory and funding into a different structure when you're trying to actually deliver care day to day as well. So it's hard and it's tricky and it's going to take a lot of courage and leadership. Mm-hmm. I think New South Wales shown the roadmap and has also demonstrated the outcomes, and we've mentioned a number of those in our paper. But yeah, it's tough stuff, and it does need a coming together of clinicians, of executives, consumers, the NGOs, the public and the private health sector working closely together. And as we said in our paper, we believe the only way you can make that happen is regionally. We've heard Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister say the Commonwealth's going to take over health and that way we can deliver it under one system. Didn't happen. No. We've heard Tony Abbott deliver the white papers and green papers around federation in health and education to try and pull all the jurisdictions together. Didn't happen. So I think we've learned a lot from what we've tried. As Di said, you don't walk away from that. You actually learn from it. Exactly. And we know now that the magic recipe is bringing all those groups together with their strengths, with their funding, with their workforce resources locally to really work on the wicked problems in healthcare with a single vision and a single roadmap. And that's the challenge for the next 10 years.
Thank you both for your time. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.